Georgia's DBHDD is warning all Georgians that half of all opioid deaths happen at home, when people take an Oxy or a Perc with a glass of alcohol for stress or to sleep. Learn more about protecting families from opioid overdoses at opioidresponse.info.
So as we start a brand new week on Political Rewind, I want to establish quite clearly that today is Monday, June 21st, 2021. And the reason I want to be careful about establishing that date is because it's kind of astonishing how many topics on this show we're going to discuss today relate to something that happened 7 months ago, the presidential election on November 3rd, 2020. 7 months ago, and yet, there are ongoing conspiracy theories, passionate arguments about the question of whether here in Georgia, Joe Biden actually won the election. And of course, this isn't confined just to Georgia. It's happening in other states around the country as Trump and his Republican allies continue to spread the theory, the conspiracy theory about the election being stolen. So we're going to talk about some of the stories that relate to that have all popped up in the news this week. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm so glad to have you all with us. For you dads out there, I hope you had a great day yesterday. I got to tell you, my kids made me so, my grown children, they were wonderful to be with. And I just loved having time to celebrate our family. And I hope all of you out there did too. So let's get right to introducing the panel. Jim Galloway is here, as he is on Mondays. Jim, of course, for many years, was the author of The Political Insider at the AJC, and of course, probably has more historical knowledge about Georgia politics than just about anybody else we could think to want to have on the show. How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing fine, and just a moment away from politics, how about them Atlanta Hawks?
What an amazing night they had last night, and it's so exciting. You're right, Jim, to have a team in this city that we can celebrate that didn't collapse when it came right down to it. They move into the Eastern, they go play against Milwaukee for the Eastern Championship. So it's very exciting. You're right. Thanks for mentioning that. We're also joined by Renee Alegria, President and CEO of Mundo Hispanico Digital. Renee, you have some very exciting news from over the weekend. What happened to Mundo Hispanico?
First of all, thank you for having me again, Bill. It's always fun to be on the show. As we were discussing before the show started, when you asked how my weekend went great because Mundo won 8 Emmy Awards on Saturday night. So we're a very happy news company at the moment. The staff is amazing, and we just try to get our stories out there in the best way we can, and it was a great validation. So there you go.
For we should point out that this is for Mundo Hispanico Digital, because digital sites are now included in the Emmy. So congratulations to you.
Thank you
for that. We're very happy to have back with us Alan Abramowitz, political science professor at Emory University, and one of the really most insightful prognosticators based on the data that he crunches in every election cycle of what we might expect to see in election outcomes. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you, and I did forecast that the Hawks would beat the 76ers in 7 games.
Did you really?
No. Definitely not.
We are going to assume, Alan, we are going to assume that nothing after that comment that you're saying is fake news. We're going to assume that from this point on, everything you say will be fact-based or interpreted or accurately interpreted. We're joined also for the first time on the show today by Professor Adrian Jones, Morehouse College. Professor Jones is a professor of political science, but she also has a law degree, and I think you certainly continue to write about and get involved in matters related to the law. Have I got that right, Adrian?
You do have that right. And on the Morehouse campus, I, along with my other colleagues, prepare students for law school and send them off to fantastic careers.
Tell us, because it's your first appearance, I want to give the listeners a little chance to know just a bit more about you. Where did you come to Atlanta from? Where did you grow up? Just a real quick capsule summary of your past.
So I consider myself a New Yorker, although I was not actually born there. And I did a fellowship to complete my dissertation at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville almost right before I came. And I've been down here in Georgia for about 5 years. And my main focus of study is has been the Voting Rights Act and then voter suppression and voter access. And so I write and think about those issues and try to make sure that people are informed about what's happening with local and national elections and that they understand the kinds of issues that have emerged from the 2020 election, for example, some of which we'll speak about today.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Let's plunge into these issues.
Thank you for having me.
Jim, sure. Jim, today we are going to see the continuation of a lawsuit that was filed earlier this year in Henry County Court, a lawsuit by an organization, Garland Favorito, who has been a longtime sort of he's a guy who, you know, thinks of himself as an election expert. He's perpetuated a number of conspiracy theories over the years as well, though. And he went to court claiming that there was massive fraud in Fulton County, especially in the absentee balloting in Fulton County. And Chief Judge of the Henry County Superior Court, Brian Amaro, said that, yes, indeed, Favorito's request that the Fulton County absentee ballots be recounted should go forward. And we thought that that was going to happen already, but Fulton County Commission and others in the case made an appeal immediately to the judge. And today, Judge Amaro is going to hear whether or not the recount should be stopped entirely. Right?
Right. This is a hearing on a motion to dismiss, and I believe it's going to be virtual. So it's not something we can sit in on, I think this is not quite as disturbing as Arizona, but it's pretty darn close. The judge has said that Fulton County will retain custody of the ballots. They will not hand the ballots over to a third party, as happened in Arizona. Nor will Favorito's group get access to the voting machines. That will remain a preserve of the county, and so there will be no tampering there. Look, this is we've got two tracks going here. We've got on one hand, we've got all these little lawsuits, which are they're proliferating under Donald Trump's beneficence, if you will. I mean, he has smiled upon the Arizona account, and so you've seen them pop up in a number of states. But then there's the second track. And that's the actual fact-finding that's going on in the aftermath of the November 3rd election. And I know we'll get to it later, but, you know, it, just the fact that you have this happening in Henry County and that email about BJ PAC becoming a topic of a U.S. House investigation into why he quit. The presumption is that he was pressured after he refused to look into some fairly corkscrew theories.
Alan, here's what Favorito alleges in the lawsuit that they initially filed. The lawsuit alleges that election workers and observers who signed sworn statements saw absentee ballots that weren't creased from being mailed, appeared to be marked by a machine rather than by hand, and were printed on different paper. And the suit also repeats a claim of fraud based on security video that shows cases of ballots being pulled from under a table and counted while observers and the news media were not present. They go on to say that proper procedures weren't followed by workers counting ballots by hand during the audit. Now, we should point out that, of course, the results of the election in Fulton County, like we've now had three counts of these votes. So what's happening here is, you know, reasonably questioned by people who just want this all over with.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, what he's doing here, he's just raising some of these same issues that were raised in the immediate aftermath of the election and which were dismissed by the courts and which were dismissed by Georgia's election officials. We've already heard the Secretary of State and the other top election officials in the state of Georgia specifically refute these very allegations. I'm just frankly astonished that this judge ever agreed to allow this recount. There's absolutely no point to it. It is nothing more than a continuation of the attempt by supporters of former President Trump to relitigate the 2020 election and to once again make these baseless claims that there was widespread fraud and the election was stolen from Mr. Trump. That's what this is about. And it's just absolutely shameful, I think, that we're in this position. We see what's happening in Arizona. I don't know if it's going to go forward, but if it does, it may not be as bad as what's happening in Arizona. But we can expect to see some of the same sorts of nonsense that we're seeing in Arizona with, for example, the search for evidence of bamboo in the ballots and you know, in paper, things of that sort. It's just wacky. It's nonsensical, and it should be. The judge should just throw this out.
Adrian, I want to get you involved here, but as I do, let me quickly point out what Alan is talking about when he says bamboo in the paper. There is a conspiracy theory that the bamboo comes from South Korea because ballots were literally shipped in from South Korea to Fulton County and added to the totals. Adrian?
I also think this is dangerous, right? We're reinvigorating information that is not true along this idea that voter fraud exists. It puts Fulton County in the hot spot as a space that does not exercise fair elections. And we know that we had a clean, very effective election in 2020. And it is a danger to election workers and voting activists here in the county and in the state, right? As you are relitigating this literally and in the news, people are suffering threats that have now reemerged since the election after already being threatened for their lives because they participated in a public service that is extremely important to us being able to elect elected representatives who represent us.
Renee? Yeah, you know. I just want to chime in here. Look, I think that we are entering into this new dangerous, as Adrian put it, phase of political and our media intersecting, right? So that you get facts are just not facts anymore, and they become malleable depending on who is interpreting those facts. You overlay that with misinformation, and then you get conspiracy theories that we're going to see play out in the court, which is, astounding. This is new territory for everyone here, and I do think that we're going to be talking about the 2020 election for a generation because we're going to point to it as the crux of how misinformation and facts became interpretable in a way that is not applicable to, say, our fact-based political systems and our election systems in the courts. So, look, we're going to be talking about this for a very long time. It is scary, but I do have faith that, you know, reason will play out, and the election officials as well as the courts will rule as they have ruled on the side of facts.
Yeah. The problem here is that this may be kind of serve as a preparation for another aspect of SB 202, the election law that the legislature passed this last session, because you've got a strong signal out of Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State who was declared a hero in fending off Trump and his quest for those 11,000 extra votes that would mm-hmm. give him the state. He is now launched an investigation into Fulton County's handling audit reports on absentee ballots. Again, nothing. They've been audited, but it's more of a bookkeeping kind of a documentation of chain of custody, and he laid out some signals that might be used as grounds for a state election board, which he no longer has a vote on, to take over the Fulton County Board of Elections.
Yeah.
And that would be a very, very big development here.
Alan, we should point out that no matter what happens with this audit of the absentee ballots in Fulton County, the election outcome is not going to change, period. Joe Biden is not going to be declared the loser of Georgia, even if, there were some massive fraud that were shown that doesn't seem to be there at all. So first of all, we should point that out, Alan. But here's the other thing that I want to ask you about, because you look at voter behavior pretty extensively. You analyze it carefully. I keep thinking that the more attention that Republicans bring to fraud in the elections, their allegations of fraud, the more they disincentivize their voters from going out and voting. We saw that in the runoff elections in January when the mm-hmm. repeated claims of fraud in the November election drove down Republican turnout in the Senate race in January.
Right. So I think the Republicans are trying to walk a fine line here. On the one hand, I think they're trying to raise these sorts of issues in order to obviously not to reverse the outcome of the 2020 election. Everyone knows that's not going to happen. Everyone except some QAnon followers. What they're really trying to do is position themselves so that in 2022, that first of all, they are hoping that these changes in the election rules will make it more difficult for supporters of Democratic candidates to go to the polls. I think ultimately that's going to fail. But they're also, in a much more worrisome way, making it easier for Republican state officials to intervene and step into local election, the conduct of local elections. And that's what we're seeing with the replacement of members of some of these election boards. That's what we're seeing with the change in the rules over the governance of over the state election board, over the who sits on that board, who makes the decisions. That's what we're seeing with regard to, all of these issues. And I think the other thing we have to think about is, what's it going to be like to have an election potentially conducted by a Secretary of State, Jody Heiss, for example, as opposed to a Brad Raffensperger. Brad Raffensperger, who had enough integrity to reject these overtures from President Trump, even though he's now trying to kind of play to the Republican base in some ways and trying to kind of position himself to for the Republican primary next year. But if someone like Jody Heiss is there as Secretary of State, and he's been endorsed by Donald Trump, and there's a good chance he'll win the Republican primary, then I think the likelihood that we would see a Secretary of State who'd be willing to intervene in a way to try to reverse the outcome of an election at the local level if it goes against the Republican candidate is, I think, going to be substantially greater. And that and is very, very worrisome.
Adrian, I want to get you in here. I want to add to what Alan said.
I would add that this front loading, you know, it makes a Fulton County, for example, a fall guy in advance. So, you know, we have real facts happening when the state is taking over Fulton County or taking over a particular precinct. And we've already established that that precinct is problematic and or the Fulton County as a whole is guilty, essentially, of violating election rules. And I think that's even more problematic in rural counties, which might not have the same kind of voice as Fulton County, right? We're talking about Spalding and Morgan. You know, you cannot, we've got to somehow change the discussion to the right to vote, the right to access, how we're going to operate under SB 202, reminding people that they do have the right to get out and participate, as opposed to this complete focus on voter fraud and this defensive position that we've put ourselves in, where we're actually making this the truth. I think the United States has a lot of practice with this, right? I mean, a lot of this is undergirded by white supremacy, which are ideas that have been developed in the same kind of a way. And they are now sort of tacitly accepted. And with these elections, I think it's very important that we try to figure out how to get out of that conundrum.
Renee, let me add one layer to this and then certainly ask you to comment on all of it. New York Times over the weekend published a story under the headline, How Republican States Are Expanding Their Power Over Elections. They say, in Georgia, Republicans are removing Democrats of color from local boards. In Arkansas, they've stripped election control from county authorities, and they're expanding their election power in many other states. And Renee, the person who they single out in the lead of this article is a woman named Lonnie Hollis. She's been a member of Georgia's Troup County Election Board in West Georgia for 8 years. She's a Democrat. She's one of two black women on the board. She's an advocate of Sunday voting. But this year, she is going to be removed from the board, the result of a local election law signed by Brian Kemp. This is the New York Times reporting. And the reason for this is that previously election board members were selected by both political parties, as well as county commissioners and others. But now the GOP-controlled county commission in Troup will have the sole authority under this new law 202 to restructure the board and appoint all new members. So, Renee, the larger context for this is that when Senate Bill 202 was being debated, people were picking apart lots of different aspects of the bill and trying to figure out whether they really were voter suppression oriented or not. And in some cases, it was a little unclear. But it's becoming more and more clear that the biggest impact, political and partisan impact, may be the power that the legislature and the governor have given themselves in this law to transform local election boards and how local elections are conducted. Your turn, Renee.
Well, look, I think that this is part of something much larger that we're living through. You know, once a political party begins to tackle the actual rules, you have a political party that's fighting out of a corner. And now that we're, you know, talking about this, witnessing how this is working in our local community, you know, like Ms. Hollis, as featured in the New York Times, you know, it's going to rile up the other side. You know, Democrats are going to get engaged, involved. This is, you know, this what we're seeing in this fight being picked by the laws that are changing. again, is something that when you take a real big picture look at it, is the Republican Party that's just out of ideas. That is not something that, you know, they're gonna tackle the actual rules as opposed to put forth what their vision of this country is supposed to be. And with that, I do believe you're going to see a radically larger increased engagement from young people. There are going to be disenfranchised groups that are going to plug back in or plug in for the first time, because this reminds them of what happened in, say, their home countries. We at Mundo, we cover a lot about the immigrant experience, you know, and what happened in and is happening in Latin American countries, Central American countries, and the reason why folks immigrated to the U.S. in the first place. They're seeing this play out, and for the most part, they're like, oh, my God, we've done that, been there. That's not why we moved here. We're going to change this, and we know how, because we can vote, right? So those are my 2 cents there, Bill.
All right. Let me add one more element to our conversation about efforts to change voting laws. This is a story that really unfolds in Arizona, but it certainly has application here in Georgia. Adrian, before we went on the air, you reminded me that as the Supreme Court comes to the end of a term, they've got some decisions that will be released in the next week. And one of them is Brnovich versus the Democratic National Committee, a case which unfolded in Arizona. And it deals with two provisions in Arizona state law. One is a policy that requires an entire ballot to be thrown out if the ballot was cast in the wrong precinct. So, and by the way, that is now part of the new Georgia election law as well. And the point of that is, quite simply, if I vote in the wrong precinct, it does matter if I vote for a local official who I'm not really entitled to vote for. But if I'm voting for governor, shouldn't my ballot count in terms of a state election official or a state candidate for office? That's one part of it. And then ballot harvesting or collecting ballots by third parties is also part of this suit in Arizona that the Supreme Court will decide. So, Adrian, this will have a big impact on Georgia because both of those provisions are now in the new Georgia law. And the people who brought this suit to the court claim that this is an effort to disenfranchise minority voters.
I think this is very important, especially under SB 202. You know, according to the current rules, if you're in the wrong precinct, which lots of voters were in 2018 and 2020, particularly in precincts of color, it means that you will not have the opportunity to vote. 64, in terms of your point about, say, a statewide or federal election, 64% of provisional ballots in Fulton County this year were Biden-Harris votes, right? Those would have been disappeared if those provisional ballots had not been accepted. The other really important piece about this case is that it determines how Section 2, which is the remaining live provision under the Voting Rights Act that allows people to get relief when they are discriminated against based upon the voting laws in their state or locality, are evaluated. And so, you know, the Supreme Court's response to this decision is going to have a major impact on you know, what happens in the future in terms of the ability to get relief. Although I agree with Renee that, you know, voters will be motivated. This is in the public eye. And when these kinds of issues are loud and people are aware of them, as we've seen in our own state, people bite the bullet and make sure that they figure out how to express their opinions and get their ballots cast. So let's hope for a good decision, and let's hope for high motivation from voters in Georgia, Arizona, and the like.
Well, that's right. I think that one of the likely effects of the new Georgia election law and of similar election laws in other states is that we're going to see an effort by Democratic groups and other voting rights advocates to organize and make sure that not only the people get to the polls, but that they're educated about the voting process and how they can cast their ballots and what to do in case their vote is challenged and what to do if they find themselves in the wrong precinct. So it's disproportionately voters of color and Democratic voters who are affected by these provisions. The reason voters end up in the wrong precinct is usually because of changes in the precinct boundaries or changes in the precincts themselves and voting places. And those tend to occur disproportionately in areas with large minority populations. So there's no question, I think, that these provisions are specifically targeting voters of color who tend to be very disproportionately Democratic voters. But again, in the end, I'm not sure they're going to be all that effective, produce the results that are desired by those who are writing these laws, you know, because I think you will see pushback, you will see organization, counter-organization. And in the end, I think, people's votes will be counted.
Alan Abramowitz, you get the last word in the segment because we got to get to a break. But Alan, I do think it's important to point out to our listeners, you've been saying that consistently. All through the fight over these bills when they were being debated in the legislature, you have said just what you did there, that you think the anticipated outcome that Republicans seem to have simply may not turn out that way at all. Let's get to our first break. We'll be back in a minute with more. We're back on Political Rewind. Glad to have with us Rene Alegria of Mundo Hispanico. Adrienne Jones, professor of political science at Morehouse College, joins us for her first appearance on the show. Alan Abramowitz, Emory, is back with us. And, of course, Jim Galloway is with us as well as he is on every Monday. Jim, you alluded to it earlier, but BJ Pack is going to soon, we believe soon, be testifying in Washington in front of the House Oversight Committee. They released a tranche of emails related to efforts to pressure Pack when he was U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia as Trump and his allies were trying to overturn the results of the election. And as we all recall, Pack resigned very suddenly, very abruptly from that position. And there's was speculation immediately that it may have had something to do with Trump. And now more than ever, we think that he probably wanted to get out while people in the administration were pushing him hard to help them overturn the election results, Jim.
Right, right. And I think that if my memory is correct, the email it was simply a please call me ASAP message, and it was sent on a late Sunday, and first thing the next Monday morning, he announced his resignation, and it was immediately accepted. Trump replaced him, I think, with the U.S. attorney out of Savannah. Who ultimately came to the same conclusion, that there was no there in these allegations of election fraud. What's interesting about BJ Pack is, who is a former member of the legislature, in quite good standing. Many people have noted that he's likely got a pretty good political career ahead of him. Since he resigned, he has been something of a sphinx. He has not said a word in public about who called him, who did he talk to, what was the demand, and what was he asked to do. But now he's apparently indicated a willingness to do this, and it's going to be interesting to see how this impacts whatever political career he might have in mind for himself in the future.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll watch as that story continues to unfold. Perhaps we'll see BJ Pack in front of the Oversight Committee sooner and get more detail on just how he felt he had been pressured. Alan Abramowitz, I want to turn to you for a minute on a story that you suggested might be worth a couple of minutes. Tomorrow, finally, the New York mayor's primary race unfolds. And you said you see a lot of similarities between that and our politics here. Just for a moment, you give us your take on that before we move on to other topics, because that's a very current story in political news.
Right. Well, this is a Democratic primary. There's a large field of candidates running. Whoever wins this primary will almost certainly go on to be elected the next mayor of New York City. And there's really no credible Republican candidates in this race. And the interesting thing to me, first of all, they're using ranked choice voting, which is kind of an interesting aspect to it. But what's particularly interesting to me, in light of the fact that we're also going to have this open race for mayor in the city of Atlanta, is that we're seeing some very similar issues, that public safety and crime are the top issues on the minds of voters in New York, as they apparently are here in Atlanta. And we're also seeing something else interesting happening, which is that in these Democratic primaries in New York City, what we're seeing is it looks like, for the most part, it's the centrist candidates who are dominating these elections, with the more progressive candidates, the candidates from the sort of Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, are not doing as well. And this follows up with what we saw in Virginia, in the gubernatorial primary in Virginia, where Kerry McAuliffe, very much of a kind of center-left Democrat in the mold of Joe Biden, easily won that primary, just dominated that field, got 60% or more of the vote in the Democratic primary. And it looks like in New York City there's a pretty good chance, again, that we'll see a sort of center-left a Democrat, not someone who supports defunding the police, for example, is likely to win. And so this may have some lessons for Georgia. It may show us something about what to expect here, because again, I think I see some similar issues that are dominating they're really front and center in the minds of Democratic primary voters.
Adrian, I think it's interesting that Alan makes those points because, of course, as he says, we're seeing across the country much more progressive, the AOC wing, say, of the Democratic Party, the squad wing of the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, pushing very hard, believing this is the moment that the Democratic Party can make a sharp turn to the left and get through an agenda or begin to establish an agenda that is a much more liberal agenda for the country. But that's not how voters are responding so far in elections, and it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out, as Alan says, in the next year plus.
I agree. I think if there is a time to try to make this push, this is it, right? We're coming out of this George Floyd year. People are stimulated. They're paying attention to issues that they think are important. I don't know if we agreed to talk about the federal legislation that's coming down the pike for voters, but I think that when we're talking about, for example, these protections earlier in the hour, like for provisional ballots, we need to be paying attention to H.R. 1. Even this compromise with Manchin means that a provisional ballot would be accepted at the polls if you're in the wrong location. Automatic voter registration would be possible. You'd have early voting. There are some things lacking from that compromise, but those items are going to make a difference in the ability of progressives to be able to further those agendas if they're able to get into office in this particular phase.
Yeah, the problem is, Renee, that even as Manchin worked toward this compromise that would allow him to vote for a version of the federal voting rights bill, no sooner had he announced that than Minority Leader McConnell said, no deal, we're not going forward with anything. And Republicans in the Senate actually called it evil and an overreach of power. So the likelihood of it getting anywhere, even with a compromise, seems right now pretty slim, I think.
Well, what was interesting about Mitch McConnell's reaction was it came after Stacey Abrams actually, you know, said there was some validity to this bill from Manchin, and you just saw and heard the Republican power base up in Washington really just kind of fall over itself with anything attached to what Stacey Abrams has to say, which frankly made them look really dumb. You know, there was so much in that bill that they have for years wanted. I think it really just sends a message to the rest of the country that they are not committed to getting anything done, and nothing is going to get done until they come to their senses or they get.
All right, why don't we get our? I'm sorry, Renee. Let's get our final break out of the way, and we'll come back with time to talk about a couple more topics. Alan Abramowitz, we're certainly seeing, as crime continues to spiral out of control across the city of Atlanta, but up there in Buckhead, the wealthiest part of the city, largely a white upper middle class and wealthier community, the drive to create a separate city in Buckhead certainly is getting momentum among people who are donating to the cause and that sort of thing. It at the same time, it's a little difficult to figure out whether there's going to be real momentum. I don't think a single legislator from the delegation up there has signed on to say that she or he will push for this. We're not quite sure what might happen, but there's no question that this is going to be a big issue come the next legislative session, right?
I'm sure it will be, because this kind of, we've never seen anything like this happen. You know, in the previous incorporations of cities have, we haven't seen really cities seceding. There was this one effort along those lines on a much smaller scale that failed. But this would be huge. Because it would have a drastic impact on the rest of the city of Atlanta. But you'd be removing the wealthiest part of the city, a large part of the tax base from the city of Atlanta. It raises all sorts of issues about what would happen to children in that part of the city, where they would go to school, because you'd be taking, you'd be removing this section, Buckhead, from the city of Atlanta, but there's no school system for them to go to. So there's just all sorts of issues that are raised by this. And, to me, this is just another form of white separatism. This is just saying, we don't want to be part of this majority-minority city anymore. Because it's not just about crime. I think it's about changing demographics. It's about the sense that we no longer have control. We have no longer have the same sort of influence that we were accustomed to having over the way we're governed.
Adrian, weigh in.
Well, I really have more questions than I have answers, because, as I said, I am relatively new to Atlanta. So I wanted to follow up with, how is this different from white flight in earlier periods? I mean, you just indicated that this was a unique secession. So how is that different from, what's happened in Atlanta in the past? Kevin Cruz's title is white flight. Teach me about how this is significantly different. Why couldn't they make an agreement to use Atlanta public schools, even if they're going to secede? Because obviously the point in my mind is to separate racially, but not necessarily to give up the services.
So Jim, one of the issues here that Adrian's asking about is this. In past secessions, say the city of Dunwoody, say Sandy Springs, those communities were already part of the county school system. So by creating separate cities, they didn't change what the school districts looked like. But in the city of Atlanta, it's entirely different. You have a city school system, and if Buckhead secedes, where do the students from Atlanta fit in? More to the point, even if you could work that out, as Alan has pointed out, the tax base for the public schools, so much of that money comes out of that Buckhead community. What happens to funding for the Atlanta public schools?
Right, and I believe you have a constitutional restriction against the establishment of any more city-based school system.
Exactly.
So there would not be there would not be a Buckhead City school system, and so physically, you know, who owns those buildings that the APS would own those buildings that APS now owns? Would there be any change of ownership over to Fulton County if that were the case? And you know, we have two panelists that often show up here on Rewind who are deeply involved in this. Number one is Ed Lindsay. He's kind of the former state house rep who is representing the anti city of Buckhead effort, and Mary Margaret Oliver, a state rep who was deeply involved. She's indicated she was deeply involved in the latest annexation of the city of Atlanta of property in East Atlanta, an effort to incorporate Emory University into the city of Atlanta proper. That annexation only included 6 school-aged children and a fire station, and the negotiations for that annexation went on for months and months and months. So we're talking about a huge shift in resources and bureaucracy that would be mind-numbing.
Renee, one of the other issues here is the racial aspect of it. We watched this happen when Eagles Landing, another largely white, upper-middle-class, wealthier community, wanted to secede from Stockbridge. And so much of that revolved around the fact that they were separating from a community that had a far larger African-American population. And now, of course, you can't separate race from this Buckhead effort at secession either.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of that the overlay of it is that which we won't talk about. What's the real reason? But we're all talking about it in certain circles and others. We're not talking about it. And you're going to see it play out. The lack of details, though, is alarming from the individuals who put this on the table. Like, OK, we want to create our own city. But, oh, yeah, the kids, I don't know, we'll deal with it later, you know, like we'll figure it out later. And it's like, okay, let's be adults here. If like, obviously there's a crime, let's deal with the crime, you know, but don't use it as a fear wedge issue to carve out your elitist understanding of what it means to live in Buckhead, a part of Atlanta.
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on here. One is that the people who are leading this movement, as in the case of earlier cityhood movements in Fulton County and DeKalb County, are individuals who I think in many cases are hoping to exercise power themselves. They want to take over, essentially. We're going to be running this new city as we see fit. The other thing that I think is very strange about all of these cityhood movements that we've seen in recent years in Metro Atlanta is that the only people who get to vote on whether to go forward with this are the people within the designated area, which is carved out specifically. The map is drawn in a way to try to ensure that the people who are included in that area will support the movement to create the city. But nobody outside of that area gets any say. Even though this is going to have a tremendous impact on the tax base of the entire city and on the future outlook of the rest of the city, just as happened in DeKalb County and Fulton County with these secessions. So I think it's a very flawed system, but we've seen it happen before, and I am afraid it could happen again this time, although, you know, we'll see. This one, I think, is going to be very controversial. And, you know, as has been pointed out so far, we haven't seen the kind of support it would need to really have any in the legislature to have a chance of success.
We are completely out of time. Adrian, you want to get a fast word in?
I just wanted to say, to some degree, we are talking about race when we're talking about crime. Not to say that there is no crime, but I think that the crime discussion is one that is talking about race.
Yeah.
Right.
I appreciate that. I think that, yes. Thank you for that. Thank you to all of you for today's conversation. It was great to have you all here. Adrian Jones, come back. We loved having you on today. Renee Alegria, thank you very much. I wanted to ask you about Lin-Manuel Miranda and the controversy over the fact there are no dark-skinned Hispanics in the Heights. Maybe we'll have you come back and talk about it, because it's an interesting example of intersectionality at work. Alan Abramowitz, thank you. Jim Galloway, great to have you. Hey, tomorrow we're going to have Sarah Shulman on the show. She's written a book called Let the Record Show, which is a history of ACT UP. In New York City, the organization that was a very aggressive effort to fight the government for not responding to the AIDS crisis. It's going to be an interesting conversation. Hope you'll all join us. I'm Bill Nygut. In the meantime, take care. Stay healthy. If you haven't been vaccinated, do it, please, because then you don't have to wear a mask. See you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.